What's better in life than a bottle of wine, great food, and an amazing conversation?
My name is Kate Sullivan, and I am the host of To Dine For.
I'm a journalist, a foodie, a traveler with an appetite for the stories of people who are hungry for more. Dreamers, visionaries, artists, those who hustle hard in the direction they love. I travel with them to their favorite restaurant to hear how they did it. This show is a toast to them and their American dream. To Dine For, the podcast, is brought to you by Terlato Wine Group and American National Insurance. To Dine For, the podcast, is brought to you by Angostura. If you've ever made a cocktail at home, you've most likely shaken Angostura bitters into your cocktail at the very end of the cocktail making process. In addition to bitters, Angostura has been making world-class rum for more than 130 years. The next fall cocktail you make, try the beautiful, smooth flavor of Angostura rum. It will transport you to the Caribbean islands of Trinidad and Tobago. The House of Angostura will celebrate its 200-year anniversary of turning drinks into cocktails in 2024. Cheers, everyone. To Dine For, the podcast, is brought to you by American National, offering a broad suite of insurance solutions to protect what matters most to you. For 115 years, American National has remained committed to helping people and communities make a real difference in their lives. American National supports great local community organizations led by the kind of people you hear about on To Dine For. People who are inspired to make a difference and inspire others in return. American National's philosophy is helping where it's needed helps us all. For a description of the American National companies, the products they write, and the states in which they're licensed, visit americannational.com/dine. Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us on To Dine For, the podcast, where we meet the world's most creative and innovative people at their favorite restaurant. On today's episode is Amy Morin.
All of the things I'd learned through my pain about mental strength, and that it's not always about what you do, but sometimes it's about what you don't do. And when you don't have certain bad habits, you can get through almost anything.
That is Amy Morin, a renowned psychotherapist and best-selling author of 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. It is now in 40 languages. It is a USA Today bestseller. And she also gave an award-winning TED Talk called The Secret of Becoming Mentally Strong, which is one of the most viewed talks of all time, with more than 23 million views. She has been called the self-help guru of the moment and a thought leadership star. She's had quite a background with a lot of loss and grief that has led her to become an expert on becoming mentally strong. And I'm really looking forward to diving into her background and exactly what led her to become an expert in this field. Please enjoy my conversation with Amy Morin. Hi, Amy. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Excellent. I am so excited we're doing this. I was just watching your TED Talk. Wow, is it good?
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that so much.
Well, we have a lot to dive into because not only with your books, but your career, your background, I'm really excited about this conversation, but I'm going to begin it the way I begin all my conversations by asking your favorite restaurant. If you could take me anywhere, where would you take me?
So I would probably say Havana Jack's in Marathon, Florida. I live in the Florida Keys, and it's one of my favorite restaurants. A lot of it's because of the ambiance. It's a tiki hut on the ocean.
Oh, so fun.
And also the food is good and the music's good. The atmosphere is fun.
And it really speaks to where you are, right? Like your home for you and how unique it is and how many people get to go to a place like that on a daily basis.
Right. I'm from Maine where we don't eat outside very often.
So are you really? What part of Maine?
So rural Maine. I grew up in a little town called Dexter where we had Dexter Shoe.
Yes. And,
yeah. So central Maine.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm from Massachusetts, so I know Maine pretty well. And I know there's so many really like little tiny towns you've never heard of that are so charming and really like literally would have no reason to go there. Right.
Right. Exactly.
So let's start by talking a little bit about your background. What was it like to grow up in your house? And were there any unwritten rules growing up in your house in Maine?
Oh, that's a good question. So I grew up with my mom and my dad and my sister. both of my parents worked for the post office for most of my childhood. And my older sister, she's 4 years older than I am. And if you ask the two, she's a therapist now as well. And if you asked us our childhood experiences, you wouldn't really know that we grew up in the same home because we both have very, very different stories about what childhood was like. She was playing with Barbies and doing lots of those sorts of things. I was playing in the mud, catching frogs and driving ATVs.
A little bit of a tomboy.
Yeah, you could say that, to say the least. And I love to fish. I love to play with my boy cousins. But it was good. And again, it was rural Maine. So like we didn't have a lot of things to do that were traditional. We just made our own fun in terms of going out in the woods and going to the lake in the summer and doing lots of outdoor things when we could.
Do you think your parents helped you become mentally strong? And did you feel like you had a childhood that would support mental strength?
So I, interestingly, both of my parents came from extreme poverty and very difficult backgrounds. And their goal was certainly to make it life a lot easier for my sister and myself. And I do think that because of the things my parents had gone through, like some of that trickled down to myself anyway. I was an extremely anxious kid. Like I threw up before school almost every day for years.
Really?
Yeah. And I could never really articulate what I hated about school other than when people, adults would ask me what's wrong. And I would just say it's a really long day. And yeah. I felt like that. I felt like the school day lasted about 4 years.
Yeah.
And I loved the weekends. I loved summer vacation. I loved anything that didn't involve school. I wasn't picked on in school. I got good grades. School came fairly easy to me. I think I was incredibly bored. And I think I missed my mother. And so I just thought, man, my mom gets to do cool stuff during the day. And I have to sit in a classroom.
Let me stop you there, because even though you say this, your feelings about school, you went on to have quite an academic career. I mean, you're an author. You're someone who really is an expert in psychology and stress management. Obviously, the anxiety, we can see where that's coming from, right? You have to experience real anxiety to be able to empathize and help people, I think, with anxiety.
That's just it. I think it gave me a whole new perspective. And it wasn't that anything traumatic personally happened to me as a kid. I was just a really anxious kid and I was incredibly shy. I didn't talk. I had wonderful friends and a sister who spoke for me. So I really didn't need to talk. If I had a question, I would just whisper it to my friends and they would ask for me. And so they kind of made life easy. They accommodated, I guess, my anxiety in lots of ways, which at the time I thought was wonderful, but it also didn't make me work through the anxiety either.
When you graduated college, what did you want to do and who did you want to be?
I guess when I graduated college, I had come to the conclusion by the time I graduated that I wanted to be a therapist. And then I decided to go on to grad school. And I had expected I would stay in rural Maine and be a therapist. And I did that for much of my career. My sister and I, she went on to become a therapist as well. And we had adjoining offices in northern Maine together. And that was really cool. And it was sort of a fun thing to do before I started living this other career where I started writing books.
So we're going to pause here because from your college experience to when you did the TED Talk, a lot happened. And I don't want to give it away. I really feel like people should go and watch your TED Talk. It's one of the most watched TED Talks of all time. And you're very vulnerable. You share a lot of loss and grief. But if you could explain to the listeners what happened to you that led you to that TED Talk in sort of an overview fashion, I think it would be helpful for people to understand your story.
Sure. So I started my career as a therapist when I was 22, but then my mom passed away when I was 23. And as I said a little bit ago, that was my biggest fear in life, was not having my mom. And even though I was an adult, I still thought there's so many things in my life I had expected my mom to be there for. And it was really that journey of my own grief that taught me the most about mental strength and put me on a path to say, okay, it's not just about teaching people what I learned in college anymore, but it's also about now I have this other experience and what am I learning from my pain and how do I turn that into something? Mm. And 3 years to the day, 3 year anniversary of the day my mom died, my 26-year-old husband had a heart attack and passed away. Mm. And my mom had died from brain aneurysm. So it's very similar that she was here 1 minute and gone the next. My
husband, sudden deaths, very
exactly.
Sudden deaths.
Exactly. They were both seemingly fine 1 minute and gone. And it really did a number on my brain to figure out, like, how do I process the fact that two of my favorite people in life are now gone? Mm-hmm. All of these dreams I had for my life in an instant went away. So it wasn't like I was just grieving the loss of them. I was grieving the kind of life I thought I was going to live. And to be a therapist where you're like, oh, I'm supposed to go to work and help other people deal with their problems. I'm a widow. I don't have my mom. My entire life was just upside down. But it wasn't even an option to not go to work. I had to go to work because otherwise I'm going to now also be homeless without my husband's income. And you'd think I'd have the words to describe that time in my life. I'm an author and I'm a therapist. I still don't have the words. It's been a long time now, but it's just, it was a dark time to say the least. And I wouldn't wish it on anybody. But that pain certainly taught me a lot. And that was one of the things that led to my TED Talk, was all of the things I'd learned through my pain about mental strength, and that it's not always about what you do, but sometimes it's about what you don't do. And when you don't have certain bad habits, you can get through almost anything.
You know, it's funny when we talk about mentally strong people, what you don't see, and we all know someone who's like really mentally strong, what you don't see is all the things in life that happened to them that led to being mentally strong. Like you mentioned in your TED Talk, it's a muscle that you have to work out because that's how you become mentally strong. Take me through some of those little things, either things you did do or things you didn't do that you think really helped you and perhaps could help someone listening.
I think the biggest one was to not feel sorry for myself. I was in that place where I'm 26. My friends are just starting to get married. They're talking about kids. And I think, here's my life. I'm a widow now.
Yeah.
All of these things I had wanted were gone. But if I had learned anything too as a therapist, it was like, it doesn't really matter what happens to you in life. What really matters is how you respond to it. It sounds cliche, yes, but it's absolutely true. The people who would come into my therapy office, some of them had been through horrific experiences. Sometimes it was like tragedy after tragedy. And some of them still had so much hope and they were kind people and they hadn't gotten bitter about life. And when I really looked at what that was that helped these people, it was just that they never really succumbed to self-pity. They didn't say, I deserve better. Instead, they would still say, you know, there are things I have to be grateful for. And yes, this was hard, but they accepted that was part of life. There are going to be ups and downs. And I wanted to do that in my life. This wasn't what I thought I was going to sign up for. But if this is the hand I was dealt, okay, let's figure out how to get through it without feeling sorry for myself.
Right. And how to make the best of it. It sounds like I'm writing it off, you know, because what you went through was just devastating. For any person can see that. So to say, oh, let's just make the best of it, sounds like you're really in the wrong tone. But at the heart of what you're saying is that, like, how can we make you have the best life going forward, having to endure this incredible grief? I wanted to ask, you mentioned the people who you saw that were getting through really difficult stuff, even more difficult than what you went through. Do you think it's intrinsic and innate, that sense of positivity, that sense of lack of self-pity? Or do you think it's something that can be, I don't want to say taught, but guided to?
I believe personality plays a role. Some people are just born more naturally optimistic than other people. But I also believe we all have the opportunity to learn those skills. How do you practice gratitude? How do you make sure that you embrace the pain without going around it? Our tendency is to say, I'm going to avoid pain. That's what causes the long-term suffering. But to say, I'm going to acknowledge that I feel bad, yet I don't have to exaggerate it. I don't have to convince myself that my life is the worst life on the planet and that and life is never going to be good again. That's where we get into that suffering. So I think it's a combination. Some of us are inherently more positive, but the rest of us can also learn how do you practice these skills every day.
We'll have more on this conversation in just a minute. But first, thank you to our sponsors.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
To Dine For, the podcast, is brought to you by American National, offering a broad suite of insurance solutions to protect what matters most to you.
There's a funny thing about most insurance commercials, whether they feature lizards or birds or funny cartoon characters. It seems like they want you to think about anything but insurance. American National, on the other hand, has real local agents who get to know you, so they can help you reach better decisions about your insurance to make sure you're protecting what matters most to you. American National agents are part of your community. They're your neighbors. So whether it's solutions for your home, your small business, your farm, or your life, you can count on your local American National agent to make sure you get the discounts you deserve and the protection you need without paying for extras you don't. With American National, you get an ally, not just a web page. For a description of the American National companies, the products they write, in the states in which they're licensed, visit americannational.com/dine.
To Dine For, the podcast, is brought to you by Angostura. If you've ever made a cocktail at home, you've most likely shaken Angostura bitters into your cocktail at the very end of the cocktail making process. In addition to bitters, Angostura has been making world-class rum for more than 130 years. The next fall cocktail you make, try the beautiful, smooth flavor of Angostura rum. It will transport you to the Caribbean islands of Trinidad and Tobago. The House of Angostura will celebrate its 200-year anniversary of turning drinks into cocktails in 2024. Cheers, everyone. Now back to our conversation.
Behind you, you have three books, and they are 13 things mentally strong people don't do, and then 13 things mentally strong parents don't do, and couples. So you've written like three different books, three different genres.
There's,
I have a couple.
Actually,
six. These are four. Oh, God. Your head is blocking them. Okay. I want to know, why did you choose the number 13, which so many people consider unlucky? And why did you choose to write about things people don't do versus things people do?
So the number 13 really wasn't meant to have any mystery to it or anything. Okay. What had happened was, after I had gone through those losses, life started to get good again. I got remarried and life was like finally looking like it, I had turned a corner. I got a new house, got a new job. And then my father-in-law got diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I just remember in that moment thinking, like, this isn't fair. How could I lose one more person? And I sat down and I wrote a letter to myself about what mentally strong people don't do. And it just so happened that there were 13 things on the list. I actually never intended to make the list public, never thought I'd be writing books about it. I was just writing a letter to myself. I found it helpful, so I thought maybe it will help somebody else. I only put it on the internet thinking 5 people would read it, but 50 million people read it, and that's why I got to write a series of books.
Did you put it on Substack, or what did you put it on, Facebook?
So I started on a website called Lifehack. And then it got picked up by Forbes. And when it got reprinted on Forbes, it went absolutely viral. And the reason I wrote about what not to do was because, you know, at the lowest point in my life, the last thing I wanted was a list of 25 things to do today. I was already overwhelmed.
Yes.
And one of the things I had learned as a therapist, too, in college, they taught me, build on people's strengths. When they come into your office, point out what they're doing well and build on that so that they feel like they already have momentum. But it occurred to me at some point, like if I were to go see a physical trainer and they told me to run on the treadmill, like I'll happily do that. But I'd be really mad if they didn't tell me that the jelly donut I ate right after running on the treadmill was counterproductive, because I'd rather just not eat the donut and then not have to run so long. So I thought, you know, I think mental strength's the same. I want to teach people, how do you work smarter, not just harder? So if somebody has a gratitude practice, that's great. But if they spend 10 minutes a day writing down what they're grateful for, and then they spend 23 and a half hours a day complaining about life, that 10 minutes of gratitude doesn't undo it. And that's really what drove me to say, okay, let's just get rid of some of these bad habits. And I know you have good habits already, and those good habits will become so much more effective when you just get rid of those counterproductive bad habits.
You know, this is so genius, because you're absolutely right. I think the average person is inundated with 5 tips to happiness,
3 ways to self-discovery, 7 ways to find your purpose, and there are things to do. But doesn't it take the pressure off when you tell people what not to do? You're like, oh my gosh, this is so refreshing. I don't have to do anything. In fact, I do less, and this is going to be great.
I found that to be helpful. Again, on the lowest days of my life, the last thing I wanted was a list that would make me feel like I had to get up and go do all of these things. I just didn't have the energy. I didn't have the wherewithal. And then if I didn't finish the list, I'd feel bad. And then it was a cycle. So I thought, you know, let's write a list of what to avoid. I can do that today.
I can do that too. So we know you've already said that what mentally strong people don't do is self-pity, right? They don't feel sorry for themselves. They realize, okay, we're on a new path. What do we do now? Give me 2 other things that mentally strong people don't do that you haven't talked about.
Another one would be give away their power. And by that, I mean, when we say things like my mother-in-law drives me crazy or my boss makes me work late, we're really implying that somebody else has power over our lives. So sometimes it's as easy as changing our language. And it sounds simple on the surface, but to be honest, even to this day, I'll still find myself saying things like, oh, I have to go to the grocery store. Well, I don't have to. It's a choice. And just taking back our power is just about acknowledging I have a lot of choices in life. I don't have to blame other people for ruining my day or stealing my time or wasting my energy. And then along the same lines, though, on the flip side of that is another one is that we don't worry about things that we can't control. Because there are so many things in life.
That's a hard one. That's such a hard one. Yes.
That we have zero control over. But yet, where do we put our energy? Sometimes we worry about how other people are going to behave, or we spend a lot of energy into like wondering what's going to happen next week when we don't have control over all of the outcomes. So it's really about then focusing on what do I have control over? My effort, my energy, my attitude, how much sleep I get, how much I eat, those sorts of things. But when you really put your energy there, it also empowers us to say, all right, I do have some control over my life. Our anxiety goes down when we focus on the things we can control. We feel better, and then we can take more positive action. And it's really that action that we take that matters.
And it takes some intention to really figure out what we do have control over, because I think most people are completely oblivious to what they have control over, and then therefore they do not act on it. Continue to go through a difficult health situation. And I will tell you, as far as energy and like protecting my own energy and not letting other people's energy into my space has had to be like a conscious effort. I don't know if this falls somewhere on the list of things not to do, but one is like let other people's opinion or energy overtake my own positivity.
I like that, because how quickly can we sometimes waste hours ruminating on a conversation that happened yesterday that didn't go well, or worrying about, you know, what if this person shows up, or what am I going to say? And suddenly that person that maybe you don't want to take up that much real estate in your life, maybe you're only going to see them for 30 minutes, but they could take up 5 extra hours of your time because you're thinking about it and rehashing it and wondering what's going to happen. And then you give that person way more energy in your life than you wanted to.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. You know, you were a professor at Northeastern. Are you still a professor?
I haven't. It's been a bit since I've taught a class. I teach off and on there.
You taught on psychology, stress management, substance abuse. You obviously already have these books. Of all the things, the different things you do, when do you feel most at home and most of service? Is it speaking? Is it one-on-one with a client? Or where do you find yourself saying, you know what, this is really most me?
Oh, that's a great question. Interestingly, it might be when I speak, and then like afterward, when people come up to me afterward and we get to have those one-on-one conversations after giving a talk, or sometimes during the Q&A when people will ask a question and they're brave enough to ask it publicly, but also when they come up to me privately and say, that resonated with me and here's why.
Yeah, because you strike me as someone who is an introvert, but you have very much an extroverted career. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that's definitely an accurate way to put it.
So where do we go from here? And how can people build some of this strength if maybe they're not facing day-to-day severity of trauma like you experienced, But I feel like you can't wait until something awful happens to you to become mentally strong. So take me from point A to point B. What can people be doing every day to get to a mentally stronger place? I guess what should they not be doing is really more along your line of questioning. What should they not be doing or doing to get in the place? Because you want to be ready, right? You want to be ready when life hits you as much as you can.
And I think that's true. And I think people often ask me about mental strength versus resilience. And people say resilience is about bouncing back when something awful happens. And I think mental strength is part of that. But also, how do you enjoy the good times in life? Part of being mentally strong can say, yeah, let's live life to its fullest, even when things are going well. Because I would sure hate to live my whole life like waiting for the next shoe to drop. Like I'm doing all of this training just so that when the next awful thing happens, I'm not as scathed. Yeah. I want people to enjoy the good times. So I'll give you a couple of strategies that can work so that people can build mental strength any day that they want. One would be to find something to challenge yourself. And it might be doing something that's a little bit scary. It could be stretching yourself to do a little bit of public speaking, or some people do cold water plunges where they stay in the water a little longer than they think they can. I don't do that because I'm from Maine and it's,
I grew up
hating cold water. Right. So, but for me, I run as fast as I can every day. I time myself with a timed mile. And three quarters of the way through, my brain will say, oh, you can't do this anymore. And that's my opportunity to say, yeah, I can. And to do something that my brain thinks that I can't do. And I think every time we do that, we train our brains to see us as a little bit more competent, a little bit more capable. And it reminds us that just because we think something doesn't mean it's true, because a lot of the thoughts we have aren't accurate. So that would be one thing. Find something every day to challenge yourself. And then when your brain tells you you can't do it a little bit longer. Another one would be, this is for people who worry a lot. If somebody says I worry 24/7, I'll often in my therapy office assign them to schedule time to worry, which sounds ridiculous, but it works. And there's research behind it. I didn't make this up, but if you worry for 15 minutes a day, every time you worry outside of that, you just tell your brain it's not time to worry yet. You can put it off.
I love that.
People will come in the second week and they're like, I spent all day telling my brain it's not time to worry yet. I said, well, that's fine. Keep doing that. But then when your worry time comes around, you sit down at the kitchen table or wherever you're going to do it, and you worry your little heart out. And when your time's up, you get up and go do something else. It usually takes about 2 weeks, but often people will come back to my therapy office and they look like the weight of the world has literally been lifted off of their shoulders. And they'll say, I can pay attention to the things going on right in front of me right now because I don't have all of those background worries going on, or I don't feel like I have to constantly be wondering what if, or thinking about awful things happening in the future because I give myself permission to do it, but just for a limited amount of time. So that's a good one for people who worry a lot.
That's fantastic. Worry.
And if I had to offer a third one, I would say gratitude. We talked a little bit about it, but it can be a superpower. And for people who write in a gratitude journal, if you just write down three things before you go to bed about what you're thankful for, it helps you to sleep better. You get better quality sleep. Grateful people live longer. They take better care of their health. They have better relationships. Like the list goes on and on. It's a superpower, but you really just have to get into the habit of practicing it every single day. And over time, you train your brain to start looking for the more positive things in life.
That's awesome. Those are great ideas. And I back to your worry time. When it is your designated worry time, I'm wondering if writing down your worries would also be even more effective than thinking them, because it's almost like when you write something down, you're like, okay, there it is. I've let it go. Now on to next bullet point.
Yes.
Would you find that helpful?
Yeah. When we put something on a piece of paper, it makes sense of it, right? All of these jumbled things going through our head, you put it down on a piece of paper. And there's actually even more research that if you were to write down a whole bunch of negative thoughts, it could be worries, it could be something that you just keep rehashing, put it down on a piece of paper and then crumple the piece of paper up and throw it in the trash, which literally shows your brain, I don't value those thoughts. And then you won't perseverate on it for the next 24 hours like you might if you didn't write it down. And you can train your brain, hey, these thoughts aren't valuable to me. You toss them in the trash and step away and frees your brain up to think about more productive things.
Yeah. So you've been so immersed in this really a very niche subject matter, but you must have so much interest in other aspects of psychology. Is there another aspect that's kind of in the back of your head, maybe you've written down, that you'd love to explore, that's kind of percolating in your brain that you'd love to write a book about?
Oh, there's so many things, but something that's particularly interesting to me right now is the link between physical health and mental health and how so many like physical activities can affect our mood. So we know that when we put a group of people on antidepressants and we have another group of people that goes running every day, the results are almost the same. That moving your body does wonders for things like anxiety and depression. Weightlifting is actually one of the best things for anxiety. And so I'm not anti-medication, but I do love the idea for some people who have side effects or they aren't interested in medication that we could do yoga, stretching. All of these things have very specific things that they can do for our mental health. And I think that would be a fascinating topic to write a book on.
You know, you mentioned briefly in your TED Talk about your mother's demeanor and that she was a very positive person and that that's why it was so shocking when she died, because she was such a sunny personality. What did that teach you, her demeanor? Do you feel like you got the same demeanor, or was that like, has that taken a while to really appreciate what she gave you with that?
I think it took a while to get there. And, you know, like even in my head, even as you say that, like she used to wake up and she'd say, it's a great day to be alive. And I have days when I'm like, oh, you know, it's raining out, or, and I'm like, you know, it's a great day to be alive. And it's just a wonderful thing for me to remind myself of those things. And she told me when I was younger, like, you know, someday I hope that when I pass away, somebody would play It's a Wonderful World at my funeral. And that's what we, right? And so that's what we did, because that was definitely her outlook. She came from extreme modest background, but she appreciated the little things in life, whether we went for a walk around the block or it was a sunny day. She just loved so many things about life.
Isn't it interesting what someone's energy can do for you? I always feel like when I'm having a bad day, like how much I could influence someone's day by just being a little happier, whether I feel it internally or not. I'm not saying to be fake, but it's just like we can actually raise the vibration of people wherever we go by kind of reaching for our best self.
That's just it. Like I was in the grocery store probably 2 weeks ago, and somebody who worked at this store turned around and said, good morning. And I felt like they really meant it. They weren't just saying good morning to everybody who walked by. And here it is 2 weeks later, and I'm still thinking about that, because what an opportunity. We run into so many people all day, every day, and you never know what a smile or a kind word or putting those positive vibes into the world could do for somebody else. Emotions are contagious, the positive ones and the negative ones. And we have an opportunity to put out the positive ones wherever we go.
Yeah. And it's especially powerful, I think, when you are depressed or you are not feeling great, to be able to do something wonderful for someone else. That is a sign, I think, of great mental strength. When you are not doing well, yet you can lift someone up.
I absolutely agree with that, that sometimes people will say, well, until I'm doing better, I can't do anything.
Right. But
I think the opposite is true. Like if you want to start to feel better, go do something. And there's always something you can do. A smile doesn't cost you anything. Or hold the door for somebody. Or say something kind to somebody. Compliment them on their shoes and genuinely mean it. So many things that we could do. And there's research behind this too. When people say I'm emotionally exhausted, I don't have anything to give. That's actually the antidote, is when you go and you give one little thing, it reminds you, actually, I do have more to give. And I'm just making a mountain out of a molehill. I'm thinking that in order to give, I have to give way more time and energy, but it only takes a little bit. And I have opportunities to do that all day long.
Yeah. And you know, and I'm not just saying this to be a kind person. I'm saying that it actually makes, when you're in a depressed state, it actually makes you feel better. I mean, it actually is something you're doing for yourself to help others.
That's right. And we know if I smile at somebody and they smile back, that like boosts my mood. Absolutely. And then I get like, oh, I'm putting out good vibes into the world.
Yes.
We're contributing something to the planet. We feel better.
Absolutely. Well, we could go on and on, because you are really a fascinating person. And folks that have not listened to your TED Talk, that's a great kind of primer to understanding you and your background. Thank you for this time. It's very cold and snowy. I can't imagine. I have a feeling why you moved to Florida after growing up in Maine. Is that
right?
Am I right?
You are correct. Yes.
Well, you enjoy your day in sunny Florida, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Dine For the podcast. For more information on the show, the guests, and the podcast, head to todineforTV.com. You can find us on Instagram at todineforTV and Facebook at todineforwithKateSullivan.
Thanks to the sponsors of To Dine For the podcast, American National and Terlato Wine Group. Special thank you to producer and sound editor John Golner. To the loyal followers of this program, cheers, stay hungry, and stay inspired. I'll see you back at the table soon.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.